You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Are you moving your business to Office 365? Working in the cloud can make your life a lot easier, but getting help, well, that's another story. And that's why you should check out AppRiver. They've got the most experienced support team in the business. You'll get free US-based support from folks who care about helping you and actually know how. If you're going with Office 365, go with AppRiver. Try AppRiver services free. Visit appriver.com/kickass. That's appriver.com/kickass. And now, enjoy the podcast.
Hello, Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Kennedy.
Dad? See, you're still the man with all the influence.
What the hell happened, Teddy?
It was an accident. I was driving.
A story like this could dominate the headlines for weeks.
Chief, we got a body.
A dead body holds a lot of secrets. Those can be the difference between guilt and innocence. So we need to be in control of them. There's not a lot of senators that are charged with manslaughter that go on to become president.
This family perseveres. We have a true compass and we follow it.
5, 4, 3.
Moses had a temper. Peter betrayed Jesus. I have Chappaquiddick.
Moses had a temper, but he never left a girl at the bottom of the Red Sea.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was the trailer for Chappaquiddick, a new movie that re-examines the car accident and ensuing scandal that cost a young woman her life and nearly ended the political career of a young Ted Kennedy. The events are largely seen through the eyes of Ted Kennedy's cousin, confidant, and political fixer, Joe Gargan, who struggles with Joe Kennedy and the Kennedy political machine for the soul of his idealistic but morally confused best friend. A heartbreaking fight he's destined to lose. Gargan is played convincingly by Ed Helms of The Daily Show, The Office, and The Hangover Trilogy in his first major dramatic role. And today Ed comes on the podcast to talk about why the Chappaquiddick incident is an oft-forgotten chapter in America's modern political history, and how making the film led him to reassess the version of Camelot he grew up with. He also reveals how the Kennedy damage control team took advantage of the moon landing to buy time, ponders Chappaquiddick's place in Ted Kennedy's larger legacy, and wonders how the scandal might have played out differently in the age of 24-hour news and social media. Ed Helms talks about working with fellow comic Jim Gaffigan on the film, bringing elements of dark comedy to the Kennedy story, and mastering that notoriously tricky Massachusetts accent. He also discusses his own politics, gleefully recalls exposing hypocrites and bad guys as a correspondent for The Daily Show, and says sometimes it was a little hard to be a Daily Show reporter and still be a nice guy. Plus, Ed talks about his start as a cocky, sarcastic voiceover guy, why he says it's good to be a fool in life, and bluegrass, bluegrass, bluegrass. Coming up with Ed Helms in just a moment. You know Ed Helms' work from The Daily Show and The Office, as well as The Hangover Trilogy and other films. Now he's taking a turn toward the dramatic with his latest outing, Chappaquiddick, opening in theaters April 6th. Ed Helms, thanks for sitting down with me.
Very happy to be here.
Well, this was a really interesting film, I have to say, but this was probably by far for me the darkest Hangover sequel yet. I mean, car crash, a woman dies. Plus, I mean, what kind of a party town is Hyannisport? Let's be honest.
Evidently, or Martha's Vineyard, rather. Yeah. It's quite a party town. I agree. It's a dark and twisted world that this movie lives in. And I believe me, I did my damnedest to make it funny.
Yeah.
And it just, they didn't use any of my improv. I'll put it that way.
There is a certain amount of dark comedy to it. The Kennedy team are put in these situations of trying to cover up for Ted Kennedy. And at one point, he wants to publicly wear a neck brace after the accident and stuff like that.
Yeah, there is a comedic aspect to the lengths that they go to.
Yeah.
And just sort of how deeply Ted spins out. There's something darkly funny about it, just because it's, when somebody's just doing something so wrong and it's so obvious and yet they're still confused about it, somehow that's kind of funny, even though obviously the events themselves and the fallout are nothing but tragic.
And in that sense, it sort of feels weirdly relevant to everything going on today when you talk about someone who's just completely unaware of the bad decisions they're making and the weirdness and how what they're doing is completely out of line with like normal basic morality.
Yeah. No, you're right. And the, I don't know, there's something that freaks me out a little bit, which is there's apparently a human capacity to allow ourselves to be confused about things that should be cut and dry.
Yeah.
And I think we all do it in certain and in small ways throughout our lives all the time. And it's sort of this heuristic that our brain uses to sort of allow us to like ourselves at the end of the day. And certain people have that in spades. And it seems to increase with power. I don't know which comes first. You know, if it's something that powerful people sort of attain, or if it's something that people who wind up in power already have or something. But it's
It's a slippery slope once you start to rationalize your actions like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And another reason there is a little bit of dark comedy in this is because you're cast with Jim Gaffigan, of all people. What was he like to work with? Is he a funny guy on set?
Jim is the best. He's an old buddy, actually, because we...
Oh, yeah?
When I first started doing stand-up comedy in New York in the late 90s, mid-late 90s, Jim was already pretty well established in the New York comedy scene, but he wasn't like a big star necessarily, the way he is now. I mean, he's one of the biggest comedians in the world at this point.
Yeah. Where were y'all working, like the Cellar or?
Everywhere we could get stage time. And for me at that time, it was just like bottom of the barrel open mic nights and this and that. And occasionally I'd get a little spot at the Cellar or this place, the Boston Comedy Club. That's where I worked the most, even though it was not in Boston. I used to MC a show there on Monday nights, and Jim came on it regularly, and I just always looked up to him because he's such a hard worker and he's so relentlessly funny.
Yeah.
Amazing. And he was nice to me. And that's
that's the only thing. Rare?
That's the only thing you need to do for me to look up to you is to be nice to me. if you're further along in your career than me and you're not a total dick, then I will look up to you. But that is kind of rare, oddly, in the comedy world.
It's so competitive too.
Yeah.
I mean, you're always worried about who you're following and who's going to go on that's funnier than you. It does seem to be kind of a cutthroat world, at least at the early stages, I suppose, when you're trying to get up there.
Yeah, I think it's really right in the middle stages where it gets cutthroat. In the beginning, everybody's kind of, you're all bad and you're all just kind of like figuring it out. And, and there's this sort of, I don't know, there's that you kind of feel like you're all at Paris Island, just going through like boot camp, getting your ass kicked all the time. And you're just bombing all the time, but you walk off stage and if other comedians are there, usually, unless you're a jerk and someone that nobody likes, when you bomb, the comedians are going to high five you. And it's like, it's just sort of this ongoing
rite of passage.
Well, it would be a rite of passage if it was a fixed event that happened like once, but it is a march of passage. It just keeps happening time after time. It's what separates the wheat from the chaff, so to speak.
Thins the herd together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you wind up with a pretty tight clique. I had so many good friends in that world. But then when you get further along into sort of the middle tier where you're working more regularly, you're getting spots and you're getting gigs, that's where the competition really kicks in. Yeah. And then once you surpass that and you're like a Jim Gaffigan, then everybody's just rooting for you because you're kicking ass.
You've made it.
Doing great.
Yeah. 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 Now, that's interesting that you say all this, because I never think of you as a stand-up guy. I always kind of assumed you came from an improv background.
Yeah. It really was both.
Really?
Yeah. So I started in stand-up, and then when the Upright Citizens Brigade opened up in New York City, it just was so magnetic. It was something I just so wanted to be a part of, and so I jumped into that world. But at the time, stand-up and improv really were these kind of symbiotic things. Like, there were stand-up shows at the UCB Theater on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think in other cities that they're more... It's more separated. Like in Chicago, there was almost like a rivalry between stand-ups and improv. Right. But in New York, it was still this embryonic thing, the improv scene, and comedians were dabbling in it and vice versa. Because the early on, UCB just needed to fill stage time with whatever.
And around this time, you were, I guess, getting your start in voiceover. Isn't that pretty much how you were kind of supporting yourself? Just doing what, ad commercials?
Radio? Just TV commercials.
Yeah.
Mostly TV and radio voiceovers.
What kind of things?
It was, it was right at the time when the dot-com boom was starting. Really, the internet was kind of this, it was a marketplace, but it wasn't a place for media yet. Matter of fact, one of my first jobs was cdnow.com. It was a website where you could go to buy discs of digital music. And it was a big website.
What, where you was would that go, like the
I'm
the,
saying
the
disc,
new version no, of Columbia House or something?
It was CDs, compact discs.
Yeah, yeah.
which ironically is digital music in a hard format.
Right.
Yeah, it was like a Columbia House thing.
They didn't manage to pivot, huh? Like Netflix did.
Exactly. It was that's exactly the right analogy. It was sort of like a Columbia House thing.
What are some of the other commercials you did back then?
I did so many. I was the voice of Burger King for a while, for a good maybe a year or so. Which just means. Yeah, like, and
what would that be? You're not the voice of the king.
I was just
we have a special this week.
Yeah,
so six chicken nuggets or whatever.
Exactly. It's funny because John Goodman at the time was like the sort of celebrity voice of Burger King. So he sort of tagged all the commercials, but I was the voice in the commercials that literally just said like, "Do Whoppers for 99 cents," or whatever it was that week.
Did you have a thing where you like the sarcastic guy or the in a world where guy? Like, what was your personality as a VO guy?
I did have a little bit of a thing, and it was just kind of this was very much in vogue at the time. Was the very dry read, like, "Hey, how's it going? You want to get this product? It's going to be really good. You should buy it." Like that sort of...
It sounds like the ShamWow guy kind of.
It's a little bit like Nicholson in Five Easy Pieces or something.
Yeah, it's like, this product is way too cool for you, but we'll let you buy it if you really want to.
Exactly. And that was every commercial you'd see on TV had that. Car commercials, credit card commercials, fast food commercials. And I just did a million. I mean, it was... If I'm honest, I was incredibly lucky to have been to have the voice of the zeitgeist at the time, like to be the right age, to my voice having matured in exactly the right way, and to have the kind of improv chops to interpret scripts the way I could tell they wanted to be.
It was the snarky gen. What would that be? Gen X, Gen X. Y type generation.
Exactly.
Now, you went to school at Oberlin College, right? Mm-hmm. Did you study acting there, or how did all that begin?
I did. I took some acting classes, and I was in some plays there. But I was really interested in film, filmmaking.
Really?
Yeah, that was sort of that was really what I pursued there and majored in. And then when I moved to New York, my first job was doing tech support for Avid editing systems.
Oh, okay. So you were working in production.
And I learned the Avid systems really well, and that's when I got hired as an assistant editor coming off of that in a commercial post house. And that's where I was just sort of immersed in TV commercials. Yeah.
That's going back to Avid.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I remember that from before I even went to film school, like communications.
Yeah.
It's like, you got to learn Avid. If you want to get in the business, you got to know Avid.
Yeah. And it was pretty fresh at the time.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't, digital editing was kind of a new thing. Yeah. Getting that assistant editing job was what sort of got me into the commercial world. And that's where I got. That's where I really honed the voiceover skills. And
now, how did you get The Daily Show? Were you a fan of the show before you auditioned for it? Or how did that come about?
Yeah, I actually was like a super fan of the show, which
so
was...
you came in prepared.
Totally. That having watched the show so much and I just knew the rhythm of it. And when I got the audition... At that time, I'd been doing enough stand-up and improv stuff around in New York that for a bunch of years, and I was on Comedy Central's radar already. Mm-hmm. So they got me in for this audition, and it was a huge audition. It was like a big cattle call. But what's funny is in the audition, they just gave me a script that Stephen Colbert had done on the show maybe 2 weeks before. And I had obviously seen it, so I knew exactly how they wanted to hear it and how Steven had done it. And so I just kind of like, I mean, I think everyone who gets on that show, it's an open secret. You just you start out doing a Colbert impression. Like, you start out just sort of mimicking Colbert and being as derivative as possible because he's sort of like, he set the tone of what a correspondent should be.
Was this around the time that he left the show?
No, it was
okay.
This was
still
well
on
before
it at the time.
So Steven and I overlapped a good 3-4 years.
I had the guy who wrote the book on The Daily Show on a while back, and he said that the field teams used to be like the gonzo journalists or pseudo journalists who were allowed to get away with murder and do all kinds of crazy things or crazier things than you could get away with in studio. Was it like that when you were on The Daily Show, or had that era kind of passed? Had it become a little more institutional by that point?
I don't know. I mean, I think it was pretty Wild Westy when I got there. There was still maybe a 50-50% chance that your interview subject would know The Daily Show. Over the course of my time there, it became 90% that they would know the show.
But there were still initially people who you could catch them. You could get
who just thought they were doing a news interview or whatever. But it didn't matter if they knew the show or not.
Yeah.
It really didn't affect how easy or hard it was to hoist them on their own petard, so to speak.
I love that term, hoist on. I've heard it over the years so many times, and finally, probably a year or so ago, I looked it up because I was assuming it was a naval term.
I read it's something like a bomb or something. But I remember reading it and being like, okay, that makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I thought it was like a Navy thing.
Yeah, hoisting. I mean, that's all you do in the Navy is hoist stuff.
Yeah. Now, you seem like a really nice guy. You often play nice guys on TV and in movies. Was it hard to be a nice guy and still play this game with the people you're interviewing and sort of set them up to dig their own hole or hoist themselves on their own petard?
Yes. The short answer is yes, absolutely. Yeah. There were a few times that I just didn't always feel at peace with it. And I still look back. I mean, there's still a few segments where I'm like, that feels that just feels icky. Like I just kind of, but I also was just sort of intoxicated by this opportunity and what everything that was going on. And the times when you felt like you were really kind of getting somebody who was a bad guy or a bad person, like someone who really needed to be raked over the coals for some reason.
Yeah.
Or just had a really toxic point of view. Those were the times where it felt, I don't know, worthwhile is a strong word, but it kind of felt like
probably like a little bit of, you were doing some social justice there. In
maybe,
some sense.
Yeah. And maybe that's kind of, going back
using comedy for good.
Going back to our opening conversation about rationalizing things that are morally ambiguous. But it was a mixed bag. It was definitely a mixed bag, and there were times I felt better about it than others.
And that has to be hard doing those field pieces because, you know, here you're trying to keep the conversation going. You're reading the other person psychologically on some level, seeing where they're going with the conversation. Yeah. You're setting them up. You probably have jokes that you want to get to. It seems like a lot of balls to juggle all at once. You have to be pretty quick on your feet, I imagine.
Well, it really was an improv game, and it was something that we would prepare relentlessly for those interviews. So when we would sit down with somebody, we'd have our list of questions, but you also have where the improv comes in is when you see an opening or you see, because very rarely would a joke, you know, we approached it the way a lawyer approaches a litigation in court. You don't ask questions you don't know the answers to. So, the producer does a pre-interview with the subject and gets their point of view and all this. And then we would sort of craft questions knowing their point of view and what we thought they would say. And oftentimes they would sort of do it the way we expected, but it may not be as funny as we thought, or they may have a more nuanced answer that doesn't work, or like, you know, or maybe they were actually onto it in some way and thwarted it.
There ever times where you would get back to the editing room and just realize you've got nothing but an hour of garbage?
I think one time I had, really? I mean, I don't know how many pieces I did, probably, I don't know, 50, 60, one time I remember it just never coming together. And there were other times where it was really hard to build the segment. You wind up kind of patching it with lots of voiceover and B-roll and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But the best moments are the most honest moments when you can really just tell that somebody is being honest and espousing a real conviction but in a context that we've created that's funny or silly for some reason. I always loved, to me, like the really silly stuff was my favorite. You know, the stuff that was more
as much as a commentary, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it was just more victimless, I should say.
Right.
Like,
yeah,
and
yeah.
I really think that Steve Carell's legacy on the show was that, like, he sort of paved that path. Mm-hmm. Colbert was just a wizard with the kind of like wicked satire. Yeah. And then I feel like Carell's path was a little more just sort of like silly doofus. Mm-hmm. They're both so brilliant. And I stole so much from both of them.
It's also what you did with this recent special. Was it the fake news with with Ted Nelms?
Yeah.
On Comedy Central. I loved it.
Oh, thank you. I'm so proud of that.
It wasn't snarky like that.
Exactly.
I mean, it was just fun for the sake of fun. It was just so over the top and so absurd. I absolutely loved it.
Oh,
I was hoping that it would become a series.
Yeah. We really worked hard to kind of stay away from ridicule, mm-hmm. or things that felt kind of like overtly partisan or mean-spirited in any way
yeah.
on that show. I'm so proud of that show. I'm so glad
was,
you saw it.
It was a blast.
Yeah,
it
we're
so
we're
much
talking
fun.
About doing more and kind of figuring out how to shape it. That was a one-hour special. It was a ton of work. I mean, the joke density on that show, I think, is what I'm most proud of. It's like, I mean, it's like 10
it was
jokes.
Like, a Zucker Brothers movie or something like
exactly.
that. It was that kind of humor. Yeah.
If you're listening and you haven't seen it, go see The Fake News with Ted Nelms. It was my Comedy Central special. I'm super proud of it.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Ed Helms when we come back in just a minute. Hey folks, I recently had a very big milestone in my life. A few weeks ago, I decided to propose to my girlfriend, and when I did, I turned to adiamore.com for the perfect engagement ring. I shopped around for a month or two, looked online and in person, and no one beat adiamore.com for the best price and the very best quality. I even went down and met with the owner, Sam, in person, shook his hand, looked him in the eye, and talked about what I was looking for in a ring. He's a straight shooter, Sam, and I don't think I've ever met anyone who knows more about diamonds. He should, because his family's been in the jewelry business since 1950. Eventually, I decided on a stunning 3-carat oval stone in a beautiful 3-stone trillion setting, and my new fiancé couldn't be happier. Visit adiamore.com/kick and browse their huge selection of diamonds to choose from. You can go on their site and try different diamonds with different settings until you come up with the perfect ring for you or the woman you love. All of Adiamore's diamonds are GIA certified, and their rings have a lifetime guarantee against material defects. Plus, Adiamore even gives you 30 days to evaluate the deal and make sure that you're 100% happy with your purchase. That's because the folks at Adiamore know that once you find a jeweler you can trust, you've got a jeweler for life, and you'll keep coming back year after year. But hey, don't take it from me. Take a look at the reviews on Yelp, and do yourself a favor. If you're shopping for an engagement ring or a gift, even if you think you're going to buy from another dealer, before you make that big decision, you owe it to yourself to click on adiamore.com/kick, look at their selection, and compare. That's adiamore.com/kick, adiamore.com/kick. Their quality and prices speak for themselves, and my fiancé and I couldn't be happier. And now, back to the podcast. I feel like I don't see you as a super political guy. I don't recall you, you know, hate tweeting about the omnibus spending bill or DACA, you know, on Twitter every morning or something like that. It just doesn't seem like your style. Do you consider yourself as very political?
Well, I am very much a news junkie. I consume lots of news, and I do have strong opinions about a lot of things. I'm a little more of a sort of conciliatory personality, I guess. But if you root through my Twitter or Facebook, you'll find a few kind of outbursts here and there that betray some political dispositions. But but I generally – I try to just be accepting and open-minded, and I really – I want the benefit of the doubt from the world, and so I try to give the world the benefit of the doubt. And I try to give even people that I disagree with or think are horrific on the surface, I try to look for the humanity there. Why is someone doing this? Why are they behaving this way?
Is that part of your Southern upbringing, maybe a little bit? You know, you don't talk religion and politics at the dinner table.
I don't think so. No? I actually think
you're from Georgia, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Atlanta, and and my parents are very Southern. Mom's from Tennessee, and Dad's from Alabama. But ironically, maybe not ironically, but sort of against expectations, they were very progressive people, and they were very analytical, very educated, and my dad was a big news guy, and he was very active in politics in Georgia. Big Jimmy Carter guy, Andy Young. He was very active in Andy Young's first mayoral campaign. Andy Young came to our house when I was a little kid, and I remember him walking into our kitchen, and I was probably, God, I must have been 3 or 4 or something.
But you were a political family. Y'all had these kind of discussions and stuff.
Yeah. But I think it was growing up in a, but I went to a high school that was a sort of affluent prep school that was very conservative.
Okay.
And so then I went to Oberlin College, which is very progressive.
Super liberal college.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, I think it's the sort of juxtaposition of those experiences where I have maybe a unique experience. Perspective on the kind of humanity of both sides.
Yeah.
And that's why I always just sort of look for that. Yeah. And it's really, I mean, sorry to bring it around to the shameless shilling of Chappaquiddick once again, but it's really what fascinates me about that story and about the script. It's what grabbed me so much is just the complexity of it. It's like, it's not, it's never just as simple as you think. And
and I don't think that people have a much of a memory for it. I mean, certainly I think, you know, despite the fact that it's such a seminal political event in our modern history, if you ask the average millennial about Chappaquiddick, you'd probably get a blank stare from probably 9 out of 10 of them. Did you have much of a reference for Chappaquiddick coming on?
I did. I don't know why.
Really?
Maybe it's because my parents were big Kennedy fans and I grew up just sort of with a reverence for the Kennedy name and the Kennedy legacy. And I think doing this movie for me was a little bit of a way to reconcile that, because it was a way for me to say, like, well, maybe my reverence for the Kennedys is a little bit steeped in mythology, and I should take a more just a more honest look at this. And can I still appreciate Teddy Kennedy's legacy despite this this like horrible thing that he did?
Yeah.
And then you, the more you dig into the Kennedys as a family, by the way, the whole Kennedy family is just steeped in like some pretty grotesque stuff, but
totally dysfunctional.
But then the speeches that Bobby Kennedy gave during, during just civil rights meltdowns. I mean, when Martin Luther King was shot, Bobby Kennedy gave a speech like off the cuff, standing on a flatbed trailer in a black neighborhood in Indianapolis, I think.
I think you're right.
It was just a brilliant moment. And it's something that's sort of unimpeachable. Now I sort of look at it as, well, I do appreciate the great things that the Kennedys did and stood for. And I don't apologize for that.
The impact is still there despite the personalities involved.
Or despite some sort of behind the scenes machinations, which are maybe horrible. And when I think of it that way, that's when I look at a Trump supporter and I'm like, well, I guess that's how they see Donald Trump.
Maybe.
It's like they can accept all these, this sort of like reprehensible behavior that bubbles up because they see an outward public value system that they identify with and that he voices. Mm. And as long as he sort of pushes the right policies and does the right things, a Trump supporter is going to sort of have his back. And that's a weird thing. I just think we're all so eager to point to what's flawed about the opposition. We just venerate our own teams to a ridiculous level. And it's important for everyone to just say, you know what? The people that we admire, they're kind of fucked up sometimes, but they're still capable of doing great things. And where do you draw the line? I mean, what Teddy did, how he handled that whole Chappaquiddick incident is it's reprehensible.
Yeah.
There's almost no... there's an argument to kind of like wash out his legacy there. And it's complicated.
And I don't think that you're alone in having these qualms about Teddy Kennedy and the Kennedy legacy in general. If anything, I'm kind of surprised that a movie like this ever got made in this town, because the entertainment industry obviously generally leans left. I'm guessing that there are probably a lot of people who would have wanted Ted Kennedy to just be remembered as the Lion of the Senate and probably weren't too eager to dredge up this chapter in his story. It can't have been an easy film to get made, I imagine.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think you're right that no one wants to, or that people who are Kennedy fans aren't excited to see any aspect of that legacy besmirched. But there's so much I think two things. A lot of time has passed, for one.
Right. And I think he's no longer alive. I don't think it would have gotten made if he were still around.
And a lot of the darker sides of Camelot as a whole. Mm-hmm. I mean, Joseph Kennedy, their father, was akin to a mob boss in many ways. And it's like, that's all on the record now. It's out there. I just don't think I didn't get a sense that people were too precious about it. Yeah. And even as a, like I said, I mean, I'm someone who grew up with a real affinity for the Kennedy name. And for reasons I can't even point to, I don't even know why, but I just, even still, this script was exciting to me because it unravels mythology, and I support that.
Yeah, and congratulations on pulling off your Massachusetts accent.
Oh,
that
thanks.
Is not easy, I imagine, especially for a guy from Georgia. I mean, many an actor has gotten pilloried for failed attempts to try and pull off a Massachusetts accent. I always think of Kevin Costner in 13 Days.
Uh-huh.
Did you work with a dialect coach on that?
Yes. that's one of the many things about this endeavor that for me was new and exciting, because I've lived in the comedy space for so long, and it's where I'm comfortable. It's what I love. It's what I always wanted to do. Going into this, it was like, just, I felt so naked because there are so many things that were new to me, like working on an accent that I wanted to get really right.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Portraying a real person feels like a loaded thing. Like that's a different responsibility. There's very little known about my character, so and it's even very hard to find pictures of him.
Right.
So,
there's no Wikipedia page. I looked. Tell us a little about him and his relationship to the Kennedy family, and particularly Ted Kennedy.
Yeah. So Joe Gargan is the character that I played, and he had a very unique relationship. He was a first cousin of the Kennedys, and his parents died when he was very young, and he wound up spending summers at Hyannisport with the Kennedy family. So he was basically a sibling to them.
He was sort of an adopted son to them.
And he was a little older than Teddy, younger than the other brothers, and he was, as they grew up, Joe was kind of Teddy's protector, and then later kind of a fixer, although not a fixer in the creepy sense, because it's by
in
all
the
indications,
illegal backroom type sense.
By all indications, Joe always had a pretty intact moral compass, and that's a little bit of his role in the movie as well.
Yeah.
He always was just sort of, he had Teddy's back, and there was a saying in the family, old Joey will fix it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it gets referenced in the movie. And Joey was a bit of a babysitter and protector.
Mm-hmm. Right from the beginning, you kind of see where it's headed, because you and Teddy are not operating on the same moral planes, really. And you go from this deep love for Teddy Kennedy and this belief in the legacy of the Kennedy family to this utter disillusionment at what he becomes over the course of a few days. I guess it really comes down to you versus Joe Kennedy and the Kennedy machine fighting for the soul of this still young, very confused man.
I love that breakdown.
To memorize that. Too much away.
The other thing that's really powerful in this movie, and that I think was incredibly powerful at the time, was the notion of family and what being a Kennedy meant. And not just being a Kennedy, but being in the Kennedy orbit. Mm-hmm. And there's that speech in the movie where Teddy says to the Boiler Room girls and Paul Markham and Joe Gargan, he says to them, you know, you're all Kennedys. You can imagine how intoxicating that would feel if you were someone who worked for the Kennedys, and here was a Kennedy calling you that name and sort of bringing you in close to the vest. Yeah. And that would just feel it would just be an incredible feeling. And I think that's what then Teddy exploits, is that loyalty that that everyone around him has, and not just Teddy, but Joseph as the patriarch, He brings in the war room out at Hyannisport with Robert McNamara and Ted Sorensen. I mean, these brilliant political minds all set to just trying to get Teddy off the hook. Mm-hmm. Like that is, I mean, that is that's loyalty to something. That's sort of a twisted sense, but it speaks to the power of the Kennedy name and the power that Joseph wielded sometimes recklessly.
Yeah, it's interesting when you get into the whole Kennedy apparatus and the machine that snaps into action once the events of Chappaquiddick unfold. I wonder, that was such a different time. I mean, three networks, the New York Times, the Washington Post, still dominated the media. Do you think that this scandal would have played out the same way in this day and age? Everyone's a journalist.
Nothing is the same.
Yeah.
I mean,
do you think he would have gotten off the way he did?
Well, I think we've learned something a little bit startling in the last year or so, which is that that accountability for bad actions rests on an acknowledgement that an assumption that a perpetrator will acknowledge the wrongdoing.
Yeah,
and if they don't, if they just hold the line that either they didn't do a thing or that the thing they did wasn't bad, then you have no recourse.
Yeah,
and that's
a horrible lesson.
Yeah, and that's something that Trump has taught us in a very sort of scary way, I don't know that anyone had considered that.
Mm-hmm. Because if you just stick to your message, you're fine. No matter whether it's true or not,
and you just kind of you just bully the message, if you don't ever accept responsibility for something, then your accusers, no matter how right they may be, are left saying, "But you still did this thing. You did it. Why?
Yeah.
You should step down, right? Or you should acknowledge something," and then. And then they come across shrill, and you get to just stay in power or keep your position. And I think that's different. I don't think that's what Teddy did. That said, the biggest difference would be just the news cycle and the social media aspect.
Yeah. Because this got bumped off of the front pages for a while because it was the same day as the moon landing,
exactly.
Right? So they were kind of counting on that to turn the page on this story before it was over.
Well, and the news cycle now, there are so many streams of news that it's I have no idea.
It's
the
confusing.
Answer to your question.
It's
I have
exhausting.
No idea how it would have played out now.
Well, as we talk about, life decisions and human frailty, I want to ask you if you have some overarching philosophy of life, because I know that you gave this commencement address at Andy Bernard's alma mater, Cornell.
Right.
And in it, you encouraged graduates, as you put it, to be a fool in life. Mm. What do you mean by that?
It was... watch the speech. It's on YouTube.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Of work in it. You know, it's funny. I've done a number of commencement speeches, and I really enjoy it because it's a real exercise in. It forces me to dig deep and kind of what can I impart to young people that might be meaningful?
Yeah.
And the answer is not very much, but I can.
A lot of people would disagree. Apparently, it was very popular.
But,
very well received.
Well, I put a lot of work into those speeches, and that one in particular. Usually, I did a lot of research on commencement speeches.
Really,
I listened to tons of them just to kind of like get my bearings and see what worked and what doesn't. And one of the things I learned, and this is that the ideal commencement speech is between 12 and 13 minutes. Right?
Okay.
So. I did one at Knox College, and it came right in at like 12 minutes and 30 seconds or something. And then Cornell invites me, and they stipulate it has to be 25 minutes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is twice as long, twice as long as the standard, as like the ideal commencement speech. So, So I really kind of went
pressure.
Yeah, had to get after that one and dig deep. But the be a fool kind of. Thesis of that is really just about allow yourself to kind of stumble through things because you won't know how the things that you're doing now are going to pay off later on.
Okay.
You won't know. And also
don't be afraid to make mistakes. Would that be kind of another
all
way
that
of saying
stuff?
It?
Yes. Yeah. And, just allow yourself to sort of stumble and enjoy those stumbles if you can, find a way or a point of view that, but it's much more nuanced
message.
Than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's better than you are the future. How did you do it?
Yeah.
How did you make it so far?
I did realize that all the great commencement speeches, and there are lots of lists of like the best speeches and so forth. And you look, if you listen to lots of them, they're all some version of Carpe Diem.
Yeah.
Like that is, it's always the, at their heart,
that's
it's
so
sort
true.
Of like,
yeah.
And so you just have to find your version of Carpe Diem.
That's great.
And yeah.
Now, do you still have a bluegrass band?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I love bluegrass.
It's like that's what I live for. All this movie star crap is just to support my bluegrass habit.
Have you played with Steve Martin?
I have.
You all played together.
Yeah,
okay.
we've played together a number of times.
Yeah, I love bluegrass. I got to see you guys perform one of these days because listening to live bluegrass, it's just such a visceral thing. It just gets into your feet and your body. And,
yeah. Well, yeah. There's something about, acoustic music. When you hear like complicated music coming at you, just through vibrations in the air, not like through electricity in any way. It's it's a really primal thing.
Yeah.
It's a primal connection.
And it is.
I mean, the reason I got into bluegrass in the first place was in my kind of angsty teen years. I was just
turned to bluegrass.
I did. Well, I was just looking for. I was obsessed. A very Holden Caulfieldian search for authenticity. You know, like looking for the roots of things, looking for the early versions of things,
which is popular now. Like roots music is, whether it's early New Orleans jazz or blues, bluegrass, that's all suddenly coming back and we're discovering the earliest versions of American music, which is exciting, I think.
I think it speaks to a yearning, in a cultural yearning for authenticity, for something that's closer to the bone, you know? And I actually have not just my bluegrass band, the Lonesome Trio, but a website called The Bluegrass Situation that's really kind of a news and info site for all just roots music fans.
Beautiful.
BGS. The bluegrasssituation.com.
Okay. Well, before we wrap up here, I was tooling around on your IMDb and I saw somewhere that your nickname in school was Chuck E. Cheese. What's the deal with that?
Thanks for bringing that up.
Is that an embarrassing situation or
well,
were
no,
you good
I think,
at skee ball?
Let's just say, that in adulthood I've grown into my features, but as a teenager, my mouth and my nose were probably a little bigger than the rest of my body. And the older kids on the swim team thought that I resembled, the mascot for a certain pizzeria chain.
And poor kid.
It's all right. You know what?
Kids can be cruel.
No, everyone, it's a badge of honor. Like the more harsh and mean your nickname was on the swim team, the more of a badge of honor it was.
Yeah.
Like that's that weird, twisted teenage logic.
Can I just say spokesperson deal?
I'd rather run from that than run towards it.
All right. Well, Chappaquiddick is in theaters starting Friday, April 6th. Ed Helms, thanks for talking with me. It was fun.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to Ed Helms for coming on the podcast. Chappaquiddick opens in theaters tomorrow, Friday, April 6th. Follow Ed Helms on Twitter at Ed Helms. Check out his website for bluegrass lovers at thebluegrasssituation.com and his own band, The Lonesome Trio, at thelonesometrio.com. Folks, if you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you send and receive calls and texts from your new business phone number. That way, you can run your business from anywhere and respond to clients quickly with Grasshopper's mobile apps. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. Again, that's grasshopper.com/kick. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.